Hello, Chicago. This is Elise Glink on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Delighted to be back in the saddle on this Wednesday, December 4th. Can you believe it's December? But boy, is it nice out. Stand in the sun, close your eyes, and it almost feels like you are in Chicago, but maybe in April. I don't know. Kind of funny that way. You can find me online at bestmoneymoves.com or at thinkglink.com. Don't forget to sign up for the free weekly newsletter while you're there. So it's Wednesday, which means we've got our very good friend, Terry Savage, on the line. Hey, Terry. Welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch. Let's try again. Terry, why can't we hear you?
Thing. I'm sorry to be on a phone line instead of in studio with you today, but it's warmer where I am than where you are.
I bet it is. Well, I wish you were in the studio, too, because there are so many things to talk about. And I know when you're standing here, we get through so much of it even faster. We wanted to start today with some of the things that are going on in the stock market. We've got some news on real estate, that we've got some news about just the stock market bouncing back thanks to, I don't know what it's thanks to, actually. Maybe you can shed some light. Maybe we should start there. What the heck happened this week?
Dow, at least the Dow is up almost 200 points, has been all day. And, it's trading on these fields. The ostensible reason, the headline reasons that you see 200 or 300 point moves any one day is what the president might have said, even offhandedly, even if it wasn't an announcement, about trade talks with China. But what's behind that is this is the time of year when corporations put into place their plans for the following year. I mean, they've been working on that for all fall, but now they have to decide, where are we going next year? Are we going to build the new building? Are we going to invest in this new machinery? How is the economy going to go? And with all this uncertainty about trade, not only trade, by the way, with China, but this past week with discussions of trade with Europe and South America, and the use of trade as a weapon, it's got many corporations on edge. So we see that reflected in jobs. We see that reflected in capital spending plans. And we see that reflected in the willingness of investors to buy stocks, except for one thing. Nowhere in the world is there a better place. We are the least worst place, the U.S. stock market.
Least worst. Did you really say
that?
That's it. Oh,
we have
goodness.
Become the least worst place because there's tons of cash floating around the world. There's concerns about a global slowdown, about debt and the ability to repay debt, especially lower quality debt. There's very low interest rates on the best, safest, acknowledged safest investments in the world, U.S. Treasury bills. And that's what keeps money coming to the stock market. But I would say without enthusiasm for business prospects next year, it's just coming to the stock market. That's what keeps it, I think, from falling more.
You know what's interesting is from the inside of companies, and we see this through our work at Best Money Moves, where, you know, companies have waited. It's December, and they're still trying to decide what benefits they want to offer employees, how they want to move forward. To your point exactly, companies have waited to the very last moment. This is December. It's the very last moment that you can decide what you want to do before the end of the year, and still some companies are sitting on the fence, just sort of
waiting. No, every company at least has to come up with its corporate benefits plan by law and give employees a chance to choose among them in December. Now, they may add choices. They may add health savings account type things. They may add different programs for earning stock options or bonuses and so forth. But that's all set in ink anyway in a public corporation. And employees have to make those choices every December. The choices, I think, that corporations are having a tough time making, and they usually would have put into place when they do their strategic plans. I mean, they start that in October and November. But they're still unwilling to pull the trigger on, let's build that factory, let's expand that plant, let's add a new line, let's go with that new product. Consumers have been taking up the slack in the economy. It looks like we're going to just go charging our way through the holiday season. But everybody in a role of making a decision doesn't want to be the one that committed to growth and expansion just when the economy falls apart. And their rate is the key to that.
Let's talk about the consumers for a minute, because you've got consumer debt at an all-time high. That's not good. You're starting to see auto loans go non-performing. That's not good. You've got student loan debt. Ridiculously, we're pushing at $1.6 trillion. And by the way, I want to ask you what you think of Betsy DeVos's idea that we create a new federal agency. Hello, are the Republicans really in charge? but to create it to, because she doesn't want to have the bad press anymore about managing the federal student loan debt. So you've got that kind of thing dragging on the economy. At some point in time, the math has to actually work some way, right? People soon have too much debt, and they can't pay payments.
A better man than I once famously said, a bull market can go on longer, or the market can be wrong longer than you can stay long. That what means is when a market is emotionally powered or powered by the fuel of a lot of available cash, the rationality of it may go beyond making sense, but the fact is the prices are marked every day, and that's what's going on in this market. Let's go back to Betsy DeVos. Do you have time before the break?
Well, let's take a quick break now, and we're going to do weather, traffic, markets, and then we'll come back and we'll talk a little bit about Betsy, and then I want to also get to your great column from yesterday about the value of giving all year long, because we focus a lot on Giving Tuesday, and yet here we are, and we need to also focus on it through the rest of the year. So stay tuned for a moment with more of Terry Savage. All right, I'm Elise Glink, back here at the Wintrust Business Lunch. We've got Terry Savage on the line chatting about money today. It's Wednesday, so of course we're talking about money. And where we left off, we were just about to dig in on Betsy DeVos's request for a separate new federal agency that would basically regulate federal student loans. They become too overwielding, I suppose. Maybe she doesn't like the negative publicity. Not really sure what's going on with that. Terry, welcome back.
Well, you're going to get me going here, so just I promise to stop in a minute.
Go for it.
Not a new agency of the Department of Education, but to be sort of the bank for federal student loans. Now, look, I have a general principle in life. The only thing worse than the government creating a problem is the government deciding it has a solution to the problem it already created. And this Betsy DeVos proposal falls directly in that category. The government has made a mess of student loans. It has created the most onerous form of debt in the name of subsidizing education, secondary, post-secondary education in this country. It is behind the student loan program that has more than doubled since 2009, since the recession. We have $1.6 trillion worth of student loan debt. The interest rate on student loan debt is way, way, way above what the government borrows at. Many student loans, because the debt remains the same interest rate forever, people are still paying off 8% student loans. Now, this year, the rate drops to a little over 4%, but the government is borrowing for 10 years at 1.75%. Worse, you can't default on a student loan, not through bankruptcy. It's going to follow you, and they know they can collect because they're taking money already out of retirement, Social Security benefits, and other benefits of borrowers who have not repaid their student loans. So government handed out money, made no responsibility on the part of the universities. It distributed through to use it wisely, and they created a huge problem. Betsy DeVos, let me just finish this.
Okay.
Betsy DeVos is one of the, and this is saying a lot, one of the most inept and incompetent federal regulators ever. They created a program, Congress did, so that if you did public service and did that for a period of 20 years, your student loan debt would be wiped out. 10 years, sorry. And they have mismanaged that program so terribly that it's like 15,000 or 20,000 people, when we have millions of student loan borrowers, have been able to wipe out their debt. They are inept, incompetent, and giving them more responsibility, or taking this away from her and giving it to someone under her control, would just be adding insult to multiple injuries. So don't get me started on student loans, because my idea is that you just re-age all the student loans. Every student loan out there pays 50 basis points higher than the government does to borrow. That would drop the rate to about 2.25%. Don't forgive them. A lot of people have worked real hard to pay off their loans. They should be honored. But make the rates affordable.
So I completely
agree. Make colleges be responsible, too, for distributing the money.
Right. So I completely agree with you on almost every single point that you made. I would like to add that I think, and I was always confused by this, back in the Great Recession, Obama had the ability to do the same sort of, let's call it a refinance, or, you know, orient those student loans, those federal student loans. And they could have dropped those rates, which were a lot higher back then. They were the 8, 9, and 10% rates that you were talking about. They could have, once the interest rates dropped, the federal rate dropped, they could have refinanced all those loans at 3 and 4%, saving people, you know, tens of thousands of dollars. And I was always confused why that option was never on the table and why he didn't just go out and do it. And I have to think it's because all of those student lenders were donating heavily across the board at Congress, and he felt like he would never get it through. But do you have any other insight into that?
It's a big, huge business. If you could be a lender, whether you're the government or a private agency, if you could be a lender, make loans, not care about the financial ability of people to repay them, really, not care.
Yeah, right.
Not care if the product, that their education was suitable for them to earn enough money to repay those loans, and then find out that and know that you could not lose money on these loans. They can't lose money.
Yep.
Okay? The lenders can't lose money. So this is a big topic, but the idea that Betsy DeVos thinks she's going to just move things out of her responsibility, it's just because she's the most irresponsible education secretary we've had, and we've had a lot of them.
Well,
and politics aside, it's an absolute, this is one that everybody, I think, can agree on, no matter what side of the aisle.
No,
student loan program does not help America grow and be a stronger, better country. It destroys a generation who are now no longer buying homes, starting families, because they just can't afford to.
Right. And to that point, Realtor.com just came out with its forecast for a major slowdown in housing in 2020 due to, in part, millennials who are still, you know, tethered to student loan debt and have delayed all the major milestones in their life. And buying houses is one of those milestones that they've just put on hold. All right, let's turn in our last couple of minutes to your column from yesterday. I really, really respect and love the idea that people should give all year round, not just at the end of the year and not just, you know, pick the one day of the year where it's, you know, Giving Tuesday, but you should really think about your giving on an ongoing basis. Tell me why you wrote that. You know,
well,
what was the impetus?
More than that, Elise, because suddenly people don't get, because they take the standard deduction, many people don't get a write-off for their gifts. And I think the entire charitable community is worried about that. So the column is up at terrysavage.com. You know, it's syndicated by the Chicago Tribune. I think there's a couple of points to be made, and I'll make them very quickly. The first is, more people spend more time, you spend more time online choosing your shoes or your clothes or anything you buy online than you do your charities. So you want to do your homework before you give, and I give a link to charitynavigator.org where you can see how well your money is used by each charity. Now, because there's no longer a tax deduction available to many people who choose not to itemize, people think, the charities worry that they won't get the gifts. One good way to get a tax deduction is to create your own donor-advised fund. It's like creating your own foundation. They're offered by Vanguard, Fidelity, Schwab. You make one large contribution in a year, maybe like this year, where you could use a big deduction, and then the money grows in their accounts the way you select the accounts, and it gets distributed in future years to recognize charities. So you get one big deduction, and maybe that's reason enough to itemize. And one more thing, a lot of people don't realize that you can give money directly from your IRA once you're 70 and a half and older. And you don't have to pay, you know, usually when you take money or RMD, required minimum distribution,
right,
out of your IRA, that's ordinary income to you. But you can give a direct gift to a charity, and it will count toward your required minimum distribution for that year, and you don't pay taxes on it. The maximum you can give, I hope this is a problem for someone, the maximum you can give in any one year is $100,000. But if you've got an RMD, say, of $17,000 this year, and you were going to give a gift of $500 to this charity or $500 to that, you can make a direct gift right out of your IRA, and you don't have to pay taxes on the money first.
Which is really a terrific point. I'm so glad you brought that up, because it's the end of the year and people are thinking about what to do with all of that, and that is a great suggestion. Terry Savage, as always, the time is never long enough, so thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Elise.
All right. Find out more from Terry at terrysavage.com, and you can find this column and all of her others there. We will talk to you again very soon. It is 12:25 on the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Elise Glink. You can find me at bestmoneymoves.com or at thinklink.com, and we'll be back in a moment with more on News WGN. Welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Elise Glink. This is tremendously exciting for me. I've got my friend Steve Ely, who's coming on the phone with us right now. Steve is the CEO of a company called eCredible, which helps people use alternative data to raise their credit scores. And he's also a former president of a division at Equifax. And so whenever I have a credit question, I give Steve a call. Steve, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Oh, thank you, Elise. It's nice to speak with you again.
It's nice to speak with you, too. And so I talked to our listeners, and I said that you would come on and give us some insight into some of the big credit mistakes that people are making. But I really also want to get into what's going on with alternative data and how FICO and some of the lenders are now starting to think very seriously and use alternative data in order to verify somebody's credit worthiness.
Yeah, it's a really timely topic. It's something that I've been focused on for, you know, 15 years of my career. And it was interesting that even just yesterday, the Federal Reserve Bank and the CFPB and three or four other government organizations actually issued a press release regarding the value of alternative data and how important it is for lenders to use this kind of information when evaluating a consumer for credit worthiness. And what it really means at the end of the day, I know that's a lot of fancy words, but there are a lot of consumers out there who don't yet have a strong enough credit file or a thick enough credit file to really help the traditional credit scoring models use what they have to come up with a score that's really representative of their credit worthiness. And so what's been happening really over the last 5 years is more and more lenders have really looked very hard at leveraging alternative data, which can be things like analyzing your cash flow out of your checking account or analyzing how you pay your utility bills, which are monthly obligations that all of us have, but we currently really aren't getting any credit for paying those bills on time. And so this whole topic of leveraging alternative data to help a lender understand your credit worthiness is really a big benefit to consumers, because at the end of the day, what it's going to do for the consumer is help them build a better credit score, look more attractive to the lender when they apply for credit, whether that's a credit card, a personal loan, a student loan, an auto loan, or sometimes even a home loan. But that's why alternative data and alternative credit is really, really become top of mind with financial institutions lately.
You know, so it's interesting because I think people really still don't understand credit, but the message has gotten through you're supposed to check your credit score. And I say that because it turns out millennials and Gen Z check their credit scores sometimes multiple times a day. I mean, I'm a little older than a millennial, not much, a little bit. And I wouldn't have even occurred to me to check it more than, I don't know, say twice a year.
Yeah, I mean, people that are checking it more than once a day are clearly being a little bit obsessive over their credit score. Yeah, and so I wouldn't suggest you do that. I think checking it a few times a year is perfectly adequate. I think what people need to understand is that you know, credit scores are, you know, created from these black boxes, these somewhat magical mathematical algorithms that come from companies like FICO and VantageScore, and you know, you can find a lot of information on the internet with respect to how they work and what the major influences are of these particular models. But there's so many nuances to them that trying to truly understand how they work and take a specific action that you think is going to make your score go up, hopefully, you probably don't want to have it go down, is really, really hard to do. And so when I talk to consumers about this every day, and I tell them, don't obsess over your score. Just look at the trend. You know, as long as you're doing all the right things so that your score is headed in a positive direction and can stay in a positive positive direction, assuming you're going to be credit active and you care about that, that's really the right thing to do. It's not to obsess over, did my score go up 1 point today, and give myself a high five for that.
Well, I think for a lot of people, you know, young people, they're so used to getting scored, getting grade. You know, they're in school or they're just out of school. They get rated all the time. They're constantly rating other people. So this rating system, I think, has filtered down into the universe of things happen overnight. But the point you really have to make about credit is that your credit scores don't change multiple times a day. It's not like mortgage interest rates, which do trade your live people, computers, whatever, trading back and forth. You know, mortgage interest rates might move several times in a day, but not your credit score.
No, your credit score, if it changes even more than once a month, that would be a lot. And of course, credit scores come from, you know, different credit bureaus. And I think that's probably where some consumers probably, you know, spend a lot of time looking at, oh, what's my score from Equifax or Experian or TransUnion, you know, the big three consumer credit bureaus. And yeah, there are going to be some minor differences there, and there's going to be some nuances there based upon, you know, how those bureaus built that credit score, when they built the score, you know, what kind of data is in your credit report at a particular bureau. You know, I get questions from consumers all the time saying, how come my credit score at Equifax is lower than my credit score at Experian? Well, you know, it just so happens that if they're looking at their FICO score, when FICO built the scoring model for Equifax many years ago that they're using, it was different than the one that they built for Experian, and it was different than the one they built for TransUnion. And so that's why you see those just subtle differences in those credit scores, which are really hard to explain, but it's just the way that it worked out when the mathematicians got together and built those models.
So interesting. Mike has, one of our listeners, Mike, has a question that he wants to ask. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
Hey, what's your question?
I'm curious, how do, like, I have four credit cards, and two of them report when I make payments, but the other two don't. But now, if I don't make a payment, they report it.
Ah, yes, that's a lovely trap, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, if they all reported it, my credit score would probably go up.
Steve?
Yeah, that's a pretty unusual situation. Most credit cards, well, certainly all the major credit card issuers, report to all three of the consumer credit bureaus. I suspect that the two you have that are not reporting, maybe they're department store cards or those kinds of cards, and that wouldn't be uncommon for them just to report to one of the consumer credit bureaus. And so, unfortunately, there's nothing you can do about that. You're not going to be able to call them up and say, hey, how come you're not reporting to all three bureaus? They're not even going to answer that question. And so the only advice I could give you is to, stop using those cards because they're probably not giving you any value, and maybe consider looking at a new card that has, you know, better benefits, more value, better rewards program, you know, whatever it is that you're looking for, and make sure that when you do apply for that card that they're very clear that they're going to report your monthly payments to all three of the consumer credit bureaus.
You can ask that upfront?
Yes, you absolutely can, and they're required to disclose that by law.
Very cool. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for your question, Mike. I think people are that confused about it, Steve, because you think that all of your credit cards are exactly the same, they're weighed exactly the same, valued that way. But no, it's not true at all. I mean, different cards have a lot of different kinds of prescriptions of how they actually go about their business, right?
Yeah, they really do, and it kind of comes down to, you know, so let's pick a credit card that is issued by your bank. Maybe you're a customer of Bank of America, for example. Well, you know, a bank like Bank of America is going to want to help all their customers have the best credit profile they possibly can. So they have some incentive to report your monthly payments to all three of the bureaus. But let's say you go get a department store credit card from a regional department store. They really don't have any big incentive to do that. They don't report to all three themselves. When they issued you your credit card, they didn't even pull a bureau from all three, your credit report from all three bureaus. They picked the one that they're working with. And so it's whatever they're doing to run their business is going to dictate, you know, who they report to. And that's not always going to be in the best interest of the consumer. It's going to be in their best interest. And so it's up to the consumer to make sure they understand that, that when they go and apply for a credit card, if one of the reasons they're doing for that is to help them have a better credit profile, make sure you get a card that's reporting to all three credit bureaus.
So before we run out of time, eCredible, tell us what you do with that and why it's so important for people who don't have credit scores or who have what's known as a thin file at the credit reporting bureaus.
Yeah, eCredible, we just launched a new product called eCredible Lift. And what Lift allows you to do is to basically come to eCredible and link all of your online phone and utility accounts. So think of, you know, gas, water, power, waste, those kind of bills you pay every month. And on your phone bills, you might be paying mobile phone, landline, internet, cable, satellite bills. You can link all those different types of accounts to your eCredible profile, and we go and get your payment history and report it to TransUnion on your behalf. And so now, any lender that uses a TransUnion credit report in underwriting, which is a lot of them, we're talking about tens of thousands of lenders, you know, not a couple hundred here, but tens of thousands of lenders that would be evaluating your credit when you apply for credit, would get the benefit of having this information included in your TransUnion credit file. It affects a FICO score that's pulled from TransUnion or a Vantage score that's pulled from TransUnion. Those are the two biggest scores out there. So if you're a consumer that is brand new to credit, maybe you just graduated from college or you just moved to this country and you're just starting to build your credit profile, this is a great way to get started that is incredibly affordable. You don't have to go out and take out a secured credit card or a starter loan with a credit union. You don't have to do any of that kind of stuff. You just pay your bills on time, and we'll report that on your behalf to the bureaus. And so for the person that's new to credit, it's perfect. For the person that's a so-called thin file, meaning they don't have enough information in their credit file to create a traditional credit score, now they can add more information and they'll be able to get a credit score. And so it's a pretty big win, and it's really intended to address about, you know, we think it'll benefit about 125 million people in the United States. So it's a great new product.
That's amazing. Steve Ely, CEO of eCredible, thanks for being with us today. I really appreciate you jumping on.
Thank you, Elise. Good to talk to you.
It's good to talk to you. Take care of that cold. I'm Elise Glink. Welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch. It is 12:50 on this fine afternoon. We've got Frank Sennett of Crane Chicago Business on the line with us right now. Hey, Frank, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. So when fine is flat, the forecast for Chicago's housing is down again. Is this news, that the fact that the realtors came out and confirmed what we all have been seeing for the last, like, 3, 4, 5, 10 years?
Yeah, it just seems to be Groundhog Day in the Chicago real estate market. You're right. The forecast for next year is to be flat to a little down, less than 1% down of the markets that are predicted to lose next year on the real estate front, to have lower sales and lower prices. There are 14 markets in the Realtor.com survey that rank lower than Chicago, so
okay,
we're not quite
better
at the bottom of the 100.
Wait,
yeah.
You know what my grandfather used to say? You never want to be the last one in a line.
That's right.
Like, that just feels terrible. If there's one person behind you, you feel a little better.
And we used to be a couple of times, twice, in fact, as Rodkin reports, Chicago was number 100 of the top 100 metros. So we're moving up. And it's a lackluster year projected nationwide. Even the top market for projected increase of sales by 3.4% and prices by 3.3% is Tucson, Arizona. So even the biggest market, it's kind of a modest increase. So what we're looking at is, you know, we still have that overhang of a huge pension obligation, $133.5 billion in unfunded pension obligation. So you kind of look and say, I don't know what my property taxes are going to end up being in 4 or 5 years. I may be on the hook for a lot. So it does seem to be having some kind of an impact on the market.
It definitely does. I think it's psychological more than real. But what we're seeing out there right now is another round of these deconversions, condo deconversions coming down the pike. We saw one big one finally close. Wasn't that? I think that was 1400 Lakeshore Drive this week. Maybe it was last week. I'm losing my weeks. But we're also seeing a whole bunch of other ones that are now coming down the pike for next year. You know, this is
River City, and yeah, there's a whole bunch. But and it seems cyclical, right? Like every 5 years, all the apartments turn into condos, and then another 5 years, all the condos turn into apartments.
Well, these buildings were all sort of condoized a lot longer ago than 5 years. So I was my husband. So my husband Sam, who's a real estate attorney, he and I were talking about how in the 70s Chicago became the great condo town, right? That was the first wave of it, and then in the 90s it kind of was a deconversion, or maybe it was they built apartments in the 70s and then they became condos. It's almost like this every 10 to 20 years, but really we're the only city, I think, in the nation that's having this condo deconversion craze.
Yeah, and it is, you're right, it is probably a longer time frame, but it's interesting. It does seem to kind of swing back and forth.
Yeah, no, it really is sort of interesting. I also want to get to this other story you had today on whether Chicago has too many restaurants. Now, I'm the kind of person, I don't eat out that much. You mean they're already closing? There's some ones on the list, and I was like, oh, I never got to that one.
Yeah, I have that too, you know, that FOMO fear of missing out. You know, it's a faux HMO, fear of having missed out, I think, because they're closed already. But yeah, the number of restaurants in the Chicago area dropped 4% from spring of 2018 to spring of this year, and it had increased 19% during the previous 4 years, so about a 5% every year, and so it's about a 9% swing to the downside. A lot of restaurants are opening and closing in 6 months or less, there's just a lot of pressure on prices with rising food costs and rising labor costs, as well as a lot more competition. So maybe it's just oversaturated, and then the offing, there's some additional taxes. You know, there's a proposed 0.25% extra on bills over $100 in Chicago. So there's a lot of forces at play that seem to be putting the squeeze on the restaurants.
I wonder, it's interesting. I don't know a lot about commercial property prices in Chicago, but I do know that it's not like they're going down. And I wonder if, I know that the labor issue and the amount that people are getting paid has been raised. We're working on our way up to $15 an hour, but any insight into whether it's also the price of actually renting out the space?
Absolutely. I mean, the real estate costs, as you say, with property taxes going up, landlords do pass along those prices to the tenants. And so, yeah, as you say, they're not going down, those storefront rents. And, the oversaturation piece, too, can't really be overstated, because if you look at, the owner of the 50-50 was talking about Division Street in Wicker Park on the 2000 block there. There was a mix when he opened in 2008 of retail and restaurants, and now there are 18 restaurants and bars just in that little span, and only 5 shops. So less foot traffic, more competition. It's really tough.
Yeah, it is really tough. And I think for people, I mean, the message is if you see a restaurant and it looks like it's good, get out there and try it before it's gone.
Good advice.
I'm just trying to give people like a little bit of the advice that I wish I had been taking myself. It's funny because I travel a lot for business. Tonight I'm actually going to be at Prime Bar, which is a restaurant I'm going to for a business dinner, and I have never been to that restaurant, and I know that they're doing great, so there's no issue there. I'm not trying to associate it, but it's nice to get out and try something new once in a while.
Absolutely. I was there a couple weeks ago, and I was hopping. So,
what did you eat?
Nice drinks. I just met a guy for drinks, so I haven't tried the food there since for about a year or so, but it's a nice spot.
Do you remember what you had to order, what your drink was?
I had a Manhattan.
A Manhattan in Chicago.
Yeah.
Why is it we don't have a drink called Chicago?
The Chicago.
No, I'm
like
serious.
That.
Well, like, there's the Waldorf, there's Manhattan, there's Chicago beers, right? But
yeah.
All right, somebody out there needs to invent the Chicago, and then we're all going to go, oh, we went to the Prime Bar and had Chicago.
I like that.
I like that, too. Frank, thanks so much for bringing all of this to the table today. No pun intended. I'll see you. We'll see you again next week.
Thank you so much.
All right. Have a good one. The news is next from Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.